Welcome back to another episode.
Okay. Should I introduce or do you want to introduce?
Well, this is, you wrote out a script for me last episode, didn't you? Where is it? There it is. I've got it. So hello and welcome back to another episode of Off the Rails, the Millennials podcast where we go off on tangents talking all things music, books and what we're obsessed with week to week. With me is my lovely co-host Imogen.
Hello.
How have you been this week? What have you been up to this week?
God, it's been a big week. We did the release of Emma and Jodie's new single, How Do I Choose? Which was really exciting, and I think it's had a really good response so far. So I'm feeling like release anxiety is gone, thank God. And now focus on the week ahead. And yeah, how about you? How's your week been?
Actually, I spent most of the weekend listening to Emma and Jodie's new release, to be honest. A bit of that mixed in with their.
It's so like emo country, isn't it?
Well, it's just so lovely. So I've been listening to that a bit mixed in with their debut single, I Don't Need a Man, for I Need a Bit of Oomph.
Yeah, you need a little bit of empowering stuff in it. Oh, I love it. What have you been obsessed with this week, I guess?
So, other than the Taylor Swift song. Because
yeah.
I kind of knew that this, because there's a whole fan theory, what are the Vault tracks? And yeah. I kind of, it's been narrowed down to a few, but obviously she's only got so many Vault tracks she's releasing.
Yeah.
There's a few. I only got an inkling it was going to be You're Over Me because I see on YouTube that all the legal versions were starting to be removed. So I was like, oh, something is coming. I kind of like that she's recorded it with Mara Morris, but in the style that she did with Colby Calais, where it's not like a solid feature, it's just like back in vocals feature, which I think is nice. So I've been listening to that on repeat. I've also been getting into this singer called Kyle. I think his name's Kyle. Yeah, so I've been listening to this new artist called Kyle, who's like this R&B hip-hop singer. And he has this song out called I Don't Wanna Fall in Love, which I cannot wait to be played out loud when clubs exist again.
Yeah.
But he has like this lyric in the chorus that is, I don't want to fall in love. Love hurts just like a knife, but you make that knife feel good. And I'm just like, oh, where he's kind of like, I want to fall in love because it feels good, but I don't want to be hurt. But you can dance to it as well, which I kind of like. Crying emoji.
Crying emoji. Okay, so before we bring the lovely Lizzie Dent on to talk about her new novel, The Summer Job, I think this week we kind of wanted to take a step back a little bit and aspects of Asian culture that we think are particularly important. This is obviously coming off the back of the hate crimes that have been happening in the States, and it's something that we just couldn't really ignore. We didn't want to gloss past. We are a podcast that focuses on all things culture, and we felt we could not have this episode. So it's just been an important episode to us. I think Maddie's there anything you want to add?
Well, I think because the Asian community is quite a minority anyway in the States, both in the UK, they always have a struggle, they always have a battle in multiple platforms of social media, and within the news. But I think it started trickling down a lot more during the pandemic, like a lot more. So we obviously saw it really blatantly in the States when Donald Trump refused to call the virus coronavirus. He'd say it's the China virus. I mean, like one little domino that was falling. The next domino to fall was like here in the UK when we had Piers Morgan on Good Morning Britain. Poking fun at the Chinese language and then even going as far to imitate a Chinese accent. And the following morning, the following day, that it was brought up that they had received a lot of complaints about his attitude. And on air, he was like, I'm not apologising for this. So that was another domino that fell down. And then I think the Asian hate crime, the hate crime against Asians has just gone up. Even during lockdown, where everyone's staying at home, it has risen massively. So one that's been in the news recently is a university lecturer called Peng Wang. No, it's Peng Wong. I'll start that again. Yeah, Peng Wong. So one of the most recent stories that's been in the news lately is Peng Wong, who is a university lecturer, who, again, he's pictures of his attack have just swarmed online because it is really, really shocking that he got attacked while he was on a run in Southampton, which isn't too far from us. But it's not the only case. It's just the most high-profile case at the moment. And it's, I don't know how to word it, but it's more than just saying it's such a shame, because if things were getting better, there's been more representation of Asian culture within different platforms, within books, within TV shows, to a point where they were very much underrepresented, and then they was trying to balance that out, and now they're too much represented, but in the wrong light, with the wrong connotations.
I think it's just this kind of this, not historically, but you know, over the past 10 years, you look at some of the, while there's been some efforts to kind of correct balance, you know, you look at sort of the underrepresentation A, and then when they are represented as a culture in you know, American Asian culture specifically, it's often misses the mark. You know, you look at, you know, the Mean Girls film, and the way that the Asian clique, you can't see but me doing it in inverted commas, is kind of portrayed, it's just so, it fulfills every stereotype, and it doesn't have any nuances. It's interesting. I mean, I think Netflix and think companies like that are making strides. You know, you look at the success of the All the Boys I've Loved Before film, and again, it's an American Asian culture. Is Lara Jean is a Korean Korean heritage. I mean, her mother, who died, was Korean, and they go back, and that's part of the film. But generally, it's still not enough.
Yeah.
And particularly in the climate that we've had over the past year, with coronavirus, we'll call it the back proper name, not what Trump called it. It's just something that I think, while there have been strides being made, it's not enough yet.
No, definitely not. I know that both myself and you are quite good at making sure that we're always reading and always listening to a diverse
spreadsheet. The thing is, last year, I remember when all the Black Lives Matter stuff kind of last year, when all the Black Lives Matter stuff came to the forefront, and you know, like, people were publishing lists of books to read, it was sort of like, yes, I want to be reading those books, but I also want to be making sure that my fiction reading is diverse, that my listening is, that it's not just about just ticking a box exercise, it's actually committing to making sure that, you know, you're reading that diversity, because as soon as if everyone reads more diverse books, then the publishers will notice that and they will start doing it, which they should be doing anyway. But yeah, I find that really helpful for me, just to know what I'm reading.
What would you say your favourite book is that you've read in the past that focuses on Asian culture, or was maybe written by an Asian author?
I loved If I Had Your Face by Frances Cha. Just because I think it's very frank, and it's just very, like, it's no stereotypes, it's just nuance, there's nuance and nuance, and all the characters are so different and so well formed. I think that was really important, and I still haven't finished it yet because it's quite long, and also I've just had a busy week. But Pachinko by Min Jing Lee is one of the best books I've read in a very long time. It's fantastic. And it's delving into, it starts off with the Japanese occupation of Korea. And it's very interesting to see the the racism posited from Japanese against Koreans in that time back in, you know, the World War times. And it's just something that I studied at a university a little bit, but it's not something I've revisited really since. So it's quite interesting delving back into that time of history. How about you?
Well, we had last year, so I ran my local book club at my local library, and I think we just realised that we were falling into this pattern of we were rather only ever really reading books written by white authors, mostly American authors, to be honest, or if we were reading books about that were written from non-white authors, they were still only based in the UK, America, or just central part of Europe. So we done a bit of a challenge month where we read books by Amy Tan. So Amy Tan is an American author, but she is daughter to Chinese immigrants. And there was just so many Amy Tan books to choose from. So we done something a bit different. We said that month that we'd all read a book by Amy Tan, but each has to be a different book. So then when we all so we all then came together, we could then say, well, my book was about this, da da da, and then we could then switch and trade books. So I got to read The Joy Luck Club. And I love The Joy Luck Club. So you have...
I mean, it's one of the ones I'm adding to my list.
Well, it's one of... It's a just a really lovely mother-daughter story or stories of four older women, the four mothers who have immigrated from China and come to the US. They form the Joy Luck Club, which is this club that play Mahjong, which is like this kind of like, not a board game, but like dominoes kind of game. And then the next generation of their four daughters and how they're trying to adapt to be American and how that's kind of in with their mothers. But lovely, lovely story. My favourite story is the one of Lena and Ying Ying. Ying Ying, very, very smart woman, but speaks broken English. So she's not really taken seriously in any of the jobs that she goes through. So Lena, who at the time is, I want to say, like 11 or 12, has to translate on the phone for her mum because she doesn't have that Chinese accent. She has an American accent. So she speaks on behalf of her mum a lot, and she gets kind of like embarrassed by her mum's broken English. But then as she grows older, she's like, well, I'm not embarrassed by my mum's broken English because it's just following the grammar of her native tongue. So kind of like exploring like the language that kind of acts as a barrier and as a bridge as she gets older, which I think is a lovely story. What are some other books that you would like to recommend?
Wow, this is my required reading for the next month that I was sitting on my bookshelf. So I've got Anna Kay sitting on my bookshelf, which is just a really lovely, heartwarming love story. Little Fires Everywhere, I read a few years ago now. I'm sure you read it.
Yeah.
It's been made into a TV show. And whilst the central characters are not... and not Asian Americans, and it's interesting seeing obviously the kind of, I guess, best back story that kind of has an effect on the full story, if that makes any sense. Is the story of a child being adopted by an American family, white American family, and kind of that play of who sort of has rights over the child, and who kind of talking about birthright. It's a really interesting and really difficult subject matter. Loved that one. I've also got on my list, which are three books which I've sort of have been doing the round. They've been really lauded by like the National Book Award and stuff. Interior Chinatown by Charles Yu, My Year Abroad by Chen Reilly, and then Mind Feelings by Kathy Park Hong. So those are three that I'm going to be reading soon.
Ooh. I will.
Lots of reading coming up.
I mentally add them to my Amazon cart.
You know what I'm like. My Amazon cart is just at all times just full. Let me check this. Is there any others which you'd recommend?
Let me just plug my laptop in before it dies. Da-da-da-da.
Okay. Also, I'm so excited for that episode out with Lizzie Dent.
I'm so excited as well. Like I said to when we had you probably cut this out, but we had like our normal book club meeting and I was telling them about the book and they're like, that sounds really good. And I was like, it comes out at this time.
It comes out on this date and you can read it and you can then listen to the podcast on it. Yeah. I'm just checking if there's anything else which there's nothing else I've really read that kind of like is particularly like putting the Asian American experience at the forefront of the book.
That's fine.
So you've got convenience store woman on your list.
Yeah, so this week I read convenience store woman because libraries are back open again, which I love. Which is by Sayaka Murata, who is a Japanese author. And it's quite interesting how she's written this book about a 36-year-old woman who has been working in a convenience store since the age of 18. She's kind of a bit lost in her life. Mm. But Murata wrote the book while she too was working part-time in a convenience store. So I think it kind of stems from that. But it's a really interesting book because she's been working at this convenience store since she was 18, and then she gets to a point in her life where she's 36, she's still working at a convenience store. She kind of struggles socially interacting. She doesn't really know how conversations kind of work. Her siblings kind of have to give her prompts of, well, you can say this and you can say that. But it's quite sad to think that it's even to the point where on her days off she'll go into work just to chat to her co-workers and like help them out.
I'm gonna cry.
But she starts feeling this pressure in her 30s, like from her family and from her friends, to be like, you're not in a relationship, you need to get in a relationship, you need to get married, you need to have a baby, and like, you've got a job, but it's not a career, you need a job that's a proper career and something that you can climb as a ladder. But she's quite happy working at the convenience store and just seeing her co-workers. I found it interesting.
That sounds heartwarming.
It is very heartwarming. It's got, I know there's mixed reviews on the humour side of it. I would say it's very, very dark humour. Yeah, because she does struggle a lot. But I think it just helped bring kind of light to, even though it's a completely different culture, just worldwide, that pressure for women. Kind of like obey like marital norms, and you should be a wife first and then a mother second and then this, and she's kind of going against the flow of that. It's a very, very interesting book. It's set in Tokyo, and I'm now interested in the rest of Murata's books because I really did enjoy this one.
Okay, I might have to mentally add that to my Amazon account too. Cool. Well, okay, so moving on to like film and TV stuff, I feel like this is much more broad, at least there's more content out there. But are there any things that you've kind of watched over the past few years that you sort of think has either changed your perceptions or that you think are important things to watch?
Oh, I think definitely, and I think I spoke about this in maybe a few early podcasts, the whole Mulan live action controversy, where yes, there's moans that the remake didn't have the songs, but it was a lot more historically accurate.
Yeah.
It was a lot more accurate in representation. You actually had Asian actors playing.
I still can't get over the fact that Jennifer Lawrence was supposedly meant to play Mulan. I'm like,
no.
Why? No.
No, no.
Thank God that didn't happen.
Because I was very much one of these people when I was little, like Mulan was my favourite Disney princess. And then I was even more happy when I found out that she was an actual real person.
Know what my favourite Disney film was.
Like the fact that she's a real warrior and she actually went up against the Huns. And I just like how Disney kind of fixed that. Like, I think there's still Disney need to fix, but I'm glad.
Oh, so much. But at least they're trying.
Yeah, at least they're trying. You're doing amazing, sweetie. They're trying.
You're doing amazing, sweetie, but you're not quite there yet. I guess two rom-coms, which I love, obviously Crazy Rich Asians, gotta be done. Always Be My Maybe, I also love, which is Ali Wong. I'm not sure where she wrote it, but I love that. I mean, I love anything Ali Wong does. Like, she's phenomenal. She's absolutely hysterical. Definitely one of mine. And I've actually started watching It's Okay Not to Be Okay, which is a Korean drama that my friend recommended to me. And it's it really delves into mental health issues and sort of, it's just beautiful. It's very heartwarming. It's very difficult to watch at times. Finished it yet. It deals with a psych ward caretaker and a children's book writer, and it's just really beautiful. It's very different. It's very well done. It's, I would say it takes a little, it takes a moment to get into because it's so different, but it really is, deals with, you know, autism and different kind of different sort of issues in the way that we handle it very well. I feel like actually quite often, I mean, autism is something that's never really portrayed well, I don't think, on television. It's always so stereotyped.
Yeah.
And actually they do it very well, and they really deal with the nuances of it, and I really loved it. So that's what I'd recommend. Is there anything else that you particularly swings to mind? Obviously this is like trying to choose one from like 50 million things out there, but
so one thing I really like, because I think the more you familiarize yourself with something, the less standoffish you will be towards it, or the more you'll find that it links to your own life, the more you'll be like, oh, this is kind of beautiful. So Comedy Central's Fresh Off the Boat, the mother of the Asian family is my mother. So though my mother is a white mother, she very much
is the same person.
To the point where there's a scene in one of the episodes of Fresh Off the Boat where they've gone to a hotel.
Yeah.
And the hotel person says, like, would you like a towel for like $5? And she's like, no, we're going to use God's towel, the sun. Because she's so frugal. And I'm just like, oh my goodness, this is my mum at Butlins. Being like, do not accept towels, do not accept drinks. I'm not having that charge to the room. If you want to get dry, just sunbathe. And I'm just like, oh my God, this is my mum.
Amazing. Oh my goodness, I love that. Well, is there anything else we kind of, I feel like it was a very whistle stop tour, obviously this is by no means complete view, but it's kind of just like a place to get started in terms of broadening and diversifying watching and reading and things like that. So is there anything else we'd like to kind of add to sort of signpost this?
I think people who kind of are now coming aware of the Asian hate crimes, I know what it is, but how can I support it? Especially during lockdown, because you can't go out and protest. You can't go out to more education, like workshops about it. I think it's quite limited on what you can do, but even though it's limited, there are still things that people can do.
Yeah.
So first and foremost, really easy peasy, just sharing on social media. So sharing the stories that you see, sharing again how other people can help, maybe some charities they can support, even if it's to a point where you can't afford to donate to these charities, you can still share them and bring awareness to them. I think the second one, again, easy peasy, just supporting people of colour. So supporting their art, supporting their music, supporting their novels, so you can either buy their novels, even if you, again, if you can't afford it, because I know that finance is struggling everyone during lockdown at the moment, you can at least share their work. It's so easy just to go, share, done. And then third one, which I know some people will find difficult, especially if you're quite a shy person who doesn't like conflict, but just calling out people on their racism, plain and simple. So I think, I always think of it as if you are passively stepping aside, or you're saying, well, it's not my place, like it doesn't affect me, it's not my place, I'm not going to be one of these people that are going to start anything, then you are one of these people who are actively contributing to the problem. It's everyone's job to stand up for everyone, and to be like, no, that's wrong, no, you can't say that, or yes, you can say that, but I'm going to call you up on it.
Well, you have now.
Yeah.
I couldn't have said it better. I co-sign everything you just said, so.
Yeah,
I think it's just making sure you're actively engaging with it and don't just brush it aside because it doesn't affect you.
Yeah.
That's just the main thing. Cool. Well,
so should we bring Lizzie Dent on to talk all about her novel, The Summer Job, that comes out this week?
Hi!
There she is.
Hello! How are you?
Good, how are you?
Not too bad. Where you're based in Austria at the moment, aren't you?
Yeah, I am. I'm in a co-working space in a tiny village above a pub.
Oh, nice. There are worse places to be, really, aren't there?
Yeah, there are.
It's so lovely to have you. So thank you so much for joining us today.
I'm so pleased to be here. It's my first podcast as a published author.
I'm so excited. Well, we loved, we've got our copies of The Summer Job now. God, it was just such a like escapist book. And absolutely, like, we were talking just before you joined, you know, it's sort of whimsical without being like cloying. It's just this so, it's so shrewd and so just beautifully put. So how long has this been in the works? And can you talk about from like iteration, I guess, to the final product we've got now?
Well, I'm just trying to remember like the thing that kicked it off. I was thinking of an idea for a novel. I actually wrote some three YAs beforehand.
Yes, you.
And I was like, oh, you know, I want to write something for adult women, you know. Yeah. Basically, I wanted to be a bit raunchier and swear a lot more.
You wanted to have that space to be able to actually like say you're right, not edit yourself almost.
Exactly. And I was trying to think, originally I was trying to think about, you know, my own experience, because I went to Scotland when I was young to work and live. It was my big OE leaving New Zealand. I went via India, you know, I was very worldly when I arrived. And, yeah, I was trying, I kind of wanted to share the experience that I had, which was like going to, from a kind of, you know, the other side of the world to the Highlands of Scotland, and like working in hospitality and all the things that came with that. So the Scottish culture, the food and wine, which I'd never been around back at home. And it was just all so new to me and kind of weirdly glamorous in a way, although I have worked in some absolute dive bombs in like...
I've worked in a restaurant in Scotland, and, you know, it's very easy to see the glamorous side, but there's also the... You definitely saw both sides in the novel, of like the glamorous side and then also the real side of it.
Yeah, I worked at this massive nightclub called Mr. G's in Edinburgh for a while, which was like, I mean, looking back, it must have held like 1,000 people. It's like one of those massive clubs, you know.
Yeah.
And it was start time 10 p.m., finish time 3 a.m., you know, and like the floor was kind of squelching by the end of the night. It was pretty gross.
Is it weird to say I kind of miss that now?
Yeah. Can you imagine being in a club and sort of shouting at a bar 3 deep with all that sweat and spit? I can't wait.
I was gonna say, I thought you were gonna be like, oh, that's horrible. I was like, oh, it sounds lovely to me right now.
I know, I was saying yesterday, I can't wait to sit down at a table I don't own with a plate of food I didn't cook and a glass of wine I didn't pour. I mean, how much do we miss hospitality? It's just, it's really a big hole, I think. Even just like so basic things like going to your pub or your local takeaway, whatever. It's just so weird to have all of that restricted, you know.
It's weird what you miss before it's gone, or after it's gone even.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly.
So you just mentioned that you've previously published 3 young adult books. How much did you find that you had to kind of alter or change your writing style for this release?
Not much actually, because I wrote my first YA, a friend of mine who is another writer, Carly Sir Isaac, she writes middle grade novels, Noisy Cry. I don't know if you know her, but she sent me an email. She said, I've just finished your book. Have you considered writing adult? And I was like, hang on. Starting out. But I think that naturally that kind of style of that book is naturally my voice, I think. Mm-hmm. And it was similar. It's a similar voice to my young adults, although those are completely different, but it's a similar sort of tone of voice, I think. It was interesting because when I wrote, I remember when the day my young adult debut came out. I mean, they were very small. They were only released in England, and I think they were in Waterstone. I don't even know if they're still available in shops, but let's say I didn't set the world on fire, but it was really amazing to kind of learn, because I'd never written anything before that. Mm-hmm. So I kind of learned how to write through that process. And then I felt like the end of the third book, I was like, I think I know what I really want to write now. Mm-hmm. And that's for women who are in their 20s and 30s and haven't found exactly what they want to be or where they fit in, or, and are kind of not always good people, you know, as well. Do shit.
What I loved most about Birdie was just, she was like, I think every woman who's 20, 30 can see themselves in her in terms of like that flawed, but also like completely, she's very lovable, but also kind of that, where does she want to be in life? I think that was just so particularly like compelling, because I don't think it's a character that's been necessarily written very much and had been spotlighted.
Yeah, I think that, like, you read a lot of novels about people who have an amazing talent, but they haven't made it work yet.
Yeah.
So they might be a great baker or a great artist or a great media person or a PR, you know, you read a lot about that, don't you? But you don't read a lot about people who just sort of go from one job to the next. They're kind of happy, but they don't have that, like, goal, that passion, that drive. Mm-hmm. And I definitely wanted to explore that, because that's how I felt. I mean, I had a really kind of, after I left hospitality, I worked in TV for a long time, and it was fun, but I was never where I wanted to be in TV, and I was too scared to kind of really go for it and you know, be a drama writer for a great big HBO series, which is a secret desire still to this day.
I can see like an English Scottish version of Sex and the City, but based in like now.
It's funny you should say that. You know that it's being developed into TV at the moment.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh. Ooh. Okay. Now I'm like, this is the TV show that I need right now.
It's really interesting, because I really like podcasts, by the way, because you can be much more candid, I think.
Yeah. Well, I think that's the thing which I also, what I like in doing it in this format, because you feel like you don't need to write. You've got your very short time slot and you've got to get through all these points. It can be much more organic, I find.
Yeah. It's really good. Yeah. So last year, like, it's weird, so I'm allowed to talk about this, but it's not announced. Yeah. So it's weird. It's a weird sort of mid thing. But so Universal Content Production, which is NBC, bought the rights. And they're currently, it's in development, and it is moving forward. It's not just like,
that's exciting,
we bought the option and we've put it on the shelf for one day. It's actually actively being developed. I'm hoping to hear an update this week, but of course these things can fall over at any stage. So it's like, I'm so thrilled it's got this fast, but you know, next week they might call and say, you know, we're not looking for anything that we have to shoot outside the US.
At the end of the day, it's every hurdle like at a time. Like, it must be just even surreal at this point to have, like, you know, your English cover and your American cover and just be able to see all of it.
I've just been doing videos actually for the US market, and like, it's just, I mean, I love the UK cover, but how good is that?
I was going to say, I kind of feel like I now need to go to the States to have both copies.
I know. That just really feels like a Friday night, doesn't it?
So true.
But yeah, so that was pretty exciting. It's been so weird, because like, from what we were talking before, like from the moment that I decided to write this book, I remember standing in my best friend's kitchen in London, mm-hmm. and saying to her, oh, you know, the book's gone out on submission, and if it doesn't sell, I have to stop this, because it's an expensive hobby. It's draining me. You know, I was exhausted by it, because I was putting in all these hours. And like, even I think one of the things about being a YA author in the UK, if you're only UK, it's really small numbers, you know, and it's a real privilege to be published, but it is hard to make a career out of it, let's say. But I remember sitting there thinking, oh God. And then like 2 weeks later, I was at work and my agent called and she was like, hi, are you sitting down?
It's like the dream pool that everyone hears, but also you're like, is this good or bad news? I don't know whether I need wine beside me or coffee. What do I need? Tell me.
I know, it's completely crazy. And the thing was as well, because there'd been so much hype around my editors, Katie Loftus, and there'd been so much hype around her book, The Thursday Murder Club. So, of course, I knew immediately who she was. I knew the company I was about to enter. And I was just like, oh, my goodness, this is fucking insane. Like, how did this happen? It's just like, it's incredible, really. And then to be here a year later and have, you know, a TV show in the works after working in TV for like 15 years and never having been able to like knock on a door and say, is it okay if I have a go at writing a script or whatnot? Am I bad?
About, you know, so your TV writing, how much do you think that that's kind of like having that experience in TV, do you think that's actually shaped kind of the way you write at all?
So in TV, I didn't do any real proper long form storytelling ever. That was always my dream, but I didn't. I worked in like promotions and marketing, which involved making shows that were kind of more like, you know, we would do like hosted stuff across a morning. So it might be, so I worked for Cartoon Network. So it might be like Saturday morning manga hour, and I would make the bit that packaged up that Saturday morning, and sometimes it was hosted and sometimes it was a cartoon, or and occasionally I wrote some scripts for minor things like, you know, some short form content that would go online, but it was never long form. And I never had the confidence to and also the training, because I didn't have a degree. Don't tell the first jobs I went to. And
people come out the woodwork, they're like, let's see, I remember in 2010 I have receipts.
Well, I did. I always used to put, because I went to university but only for a year and a half, so I always just put the university name and the years and what I studied. So I'm not lying.
No, you're not lying. It's called being a creative author at the end of the day.
But if you weren't, if you're not being thorough as an HR lady or gentleman, you would look at that and think, oh yeah, she's gone to university, but maybe I didn't finish it. Anyway,
at the end of the day, their problem, not yours. You're the published author. I think you're fine now.
Yeah. So I've gone off on a bizarre tangent now, haven't I?
That's what we do. Madeline will tell you that's what we do all the time. We start off with something and we're like, how did we end up here?
Writing TV. Yeah, so I just, it just wasn't something that I was very confident at. Mm-hmm. It's weird, isn't it? Because, like, in a way, it took me stepping out of a co-creative environment into one that I was totally in control of to find my confidence. Now, it's not to say being an author is completely alone, like Katie has edited the shit out of my book, but I was able to get something that was wholly mine, finished with no eyes on it, and then step forward and say, here's something I've done. Whereas I think in TV, because it's like, you know, I've sat in writers' rooms for TV shows like Being Human and things like that, and, you know, there's a whole group of people working on these things. It's not just one person, and you have to get in that door, and that's quite hard to do.
Particularly as a young girl, quite often it's that pushing down the door. It's like, it takes practice and it's hard to do that first battering down, I guess.
Yeah, I'm like an absolute model of a woman who had no confidence and was very intimidated by, like, I just kind of, I put people on such pedestals really easily. And I, you know, it's weird now to think, you know, I'm a published author. I mean, me, I just, you know, I have occasionally weed out my bedroom window. You know, I'm not worthy of it. And, but, you know what I mean? That's how it feels. And it's weird now. And I am realizing that I probably was good enough all those times, but I was not confident enough. And that it's when those two things come together that it, that you sort of set sail and can move forward.
100%. Before the we started recording the podcast, me and Imogen were talking about how we related to Birdie in the scenario of early in the book, how the two older women come into the restaurant and ask for some wine, and Birdie goes into the kitchen and says, "Have we got any pickpull?" And not really knowing that too much about wine, because I'm very much one of those people that when the waiter comes out with their wine tasters and says, "What do you think?" I just drink it and go, "Yep, that's wine, I'll have that." So I'm kind of curious to see how much did you have to maybe refresh your knowledge about wine, or what kind of like learning did you have to do about wine in research for the book?
Yeah, I mean, I did a lot of research. So like, I worked in restaurants and bars, but I don't want anyone to think I'm a wine expert, because I certainly am not. I know like a bluffable amount in a scenario where people are posher than me, and that's about it. which is many scenarios. But I think with the book, I spent a lot of time like with wine lists open, like I used the Ritz wine list as an example, because it was one of the kind of wankiest I could find. You know, it was like pages and pages long, you know, with 15 different
language at that point.
It's crazy. And I, you know, it's sort of weird. I was talking about it the other night actually at a book event. It's like a little bit like art. If you don't know, you don't know. But you are welcome to your own taste. You know, you have a right to your own taste, but it might not be what everyone else says is good. So they say after 10, you know, the kind of rule is, isn't it? It's like, if you pay £10 a bottle, it's a good bottle. If you pay 15, not many people can tell the difference. You know, as it starts to go up, it's not really, I don't think that's the actual saying, by the way.
It's something like that. It doesn't matter what it is. The sentiment exists, to be honest.
Yeah, it's a saying that. It's a saying that. You also spent a lot of your early 20s in Scotland in hospitality. Was it quite fun to return to that, or was there some like cringy moments when you thought, oh God, this reminds me of this scenario?
Yeah, it was quite fun. I mean, I definitely, being a young Antipodean, as you guys call us, coming back to the UK, I definitely struggled a lot with feeling like I wasn't fancy or wasn't posh, wasn't well brought up. And that definitely played out a bit, particularly when I was working in the more fancy restaurants. Like, you really do notice I wasn't raised like this. I don't, you know, my upbringing was brilliant, but it wasn't restaurants and fine wine at all, you know. I don't think my parents even really drank a beer. That was kind of it, you know. And so, yeah.
It was a whole lifestyle to learn at that point, rather than just like specifics of things. It's just, it's a whole thing. It's hard to learn for us.
It's all of that stuff. I mean, you kind of imagine the cliche of somebody sitting down and going, what are all these forks for? You know, which knife do I use? But if you don't know, you don't know. It's completely intimidating. And And I definitely had that experience. But my aunt and uncle who took me in as part of my sort of overseas experience were amazing. And I think they really enjoyed, you know, showing me the ropes of this stuff. So I did leave, like, I did leave there feeling like I can walk into a very posh scenario now and kind of get away with it. I kind of know what to do. Now I kind of get a kick out of, like, the fact that I don't know, because I do. I once went to the poshest thing I ever went to was, weirdly, a Labour MP press event, weirdly. It was so posh, just the people that ran the press, the PR company, the politicians and donors that were there. And I remember walking in there and thinking, wow, there's a whole other level in the UK. Like, there's a whole other level of posh.
Yeah.
And that's not even the top. But it's weird, isn't it? It's weird how there really is a class system here that still exists.
And you kind of can forget that it exists until you're in scenario, or, like, I mean, I haven't been into a scenario like that, but, you know, until you're in those places, you kind of can ignore it. And then suddenly you're like, oh, I feel really out of my depth there.
Yeah. Exactly.
I was going to ask you also, in sort of the press release for the book, you talked about you know, the real women you wanted to have portrayed, and all the personalities of the women in this book are so distinct, you know, from Heather to Birdie to Irene. How much were they all based on different people in your life, or if at all?
I thought really hard about all of them. Heather, to me, was the me of my insecure boyfriend relationship days, right? Mm-hmm. She was the me who pinned all her hopes, dreams, ambitions, futures on one dude that she met and was dating, you know. And I really, even though it's kind of, I think I spend less time with her, that was the heart and soul that I wanted to portray, or the me that I wanted to put into her, was that, you know, when you feel so weirdly attached to a relationship or to something, that's a codependency. So that's what I kind of explored with her. What I wanted to explore with Birdie was the side of me that was kind of not always a nice person, and was self-centered and did mean things to people sometimes, but ultimately just wanted to be liked and to fit in. So that's who I tried to explore with her. And then Irene was kind of those maternal women in your life that you meet who give you a lot of space to kind of get stuff wrong and to learn yourself, but definitely don't have endless patience. You know? Because, you know, they can't. But that kind of, and I got it a lot from my aunts, actually, when I came to England, that they give you, of course they have endless patience, but they give you a maternal guidance, which is a bit stiffer than you get from your mum, I think, a little bit more, come on, you have to do this and you have to do that, and that's a very silly thing to do. It's that aunt thing, you know, and that's what I tried to bring out in her. Really, I'm just going to plug my computer in before it goes. Yeah, so that's it. And Anais is based on a sous chef that I did work with, who was super talented but was always under the boys, you know. So that's who she's based on. And that kind of, sorry, go on.
Oh, no, I was going to say as well, actually, because, you know, talking about James and talking about the relationship, what I got out of it was, like, Heather and Birdie's relationship to me was one of the most special parts of the book, and that kind of that intrinsic bond between two people who don't really have as much of a family set up. Kind of, how important was it, I guess, to you, again, to put that light on female friendships? Because I know we talk about it a lot more now as, like, a really important relationship in women's lives, but it really is, and I love the fact that was a big part of this book.
Yeah, I mean, I can say with 100% certainty that the most important relationships in my life have been my female friends.
Yeah.
They've caused the biggest hurt when they've fallen apart. The ones that I've lost have caused, you know, years of pain, really. I mean, I still think about those friendships that have fallen away, and they break my heart, you know. But God, the men or the relationships that I have had, they you do move on from them, you know, and you can step back and look and think, why did I ever, what did I see in that person? But with your female friendships, they're so important, you know. They're a choice you make as you're growing. I think there's some that I've taken through from, you know, when I was a teenager to now. There's some that I've made as a 30-something woman, 20-something woman, and I've met them at different times in my life, and they've brought different things to the relationship, but they shape who you are, and they also keep you in check. They keep you, you know, there's an honesty to female friendships as well that I think is really important. You know, the support network is strong, but also that ability to say, you're being a dickhead, mate. You know, in a way that you wouldn't listen to your mother. What's that?
I was going to say they're almost a mirror sometimes, like the kind of mirror that everyone tries to avoid, but they are the one you can't.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, female friendships to me are just like, they're just such a big part of my life. It's really hard at the moment because I'm separated from all of my girlfriends. And so from the time that I signed the book deal, which was last February, to now, I've been locked out of my home country and out of the UK, more or less. And so I still haven't had a great big...
Oh, you're going to have the biggest celebration when you can see them again, I'm sure. It's going to be...
Can you imagine? They're going to shut down Piccadilly Circus. I'm going to take over. No, I can't
wait. I want to see this now.
Yeah, I remember when we were first talking to the press guys at Viking, Olivia, who's doing the press for the book, she said, you know, I've never wanted to throw a massive boozy launch for a book more than I want to do for this one. I was like, yes, I know. But alas, maybe for the paperback in August.
Yeah, exactly. Maybe for the paperback.
Yeah.
Now, what obviously then sets this book apart from other ones, not just the focus on female friendship, but also what struck me was the witticisms in the book. It's quite humorous, especially the contrast between James's sense of humour and Birdie's sense of humour. I was just wondering where your humour kind of stems from and how it developed and influenced your book.
I wanted to make the book funny, and I worked quite hard at that. So, like, I spent lots of times. I was like, there's got to be a witty comeback from Birdie here. So I would write something and then I would work it and rework it. And I just trying to find, like, I just wanted her to have the sharp wit of a Liz Lemon or a Eleanor Shostrop or a Mick Dobbs from La. I wanted her to have that kind of tongue. And I think it was important for her that in the man that was her romantic interest to be much more sort of more earnest.
Yeah.
Because I think that kind of having somebody who just is kind of perplexed by the more bolshy, showy side of her meant that she had to be more real to connect with him. So that's why I kind of wrote them the way that I did. Because, you know, you could imagine Birdie getting on with someone, you know, with the gift of the gab, who was super funny as well and super, but I think ultimately, and, you know, that side of my personality, I'm with somebody who's really calm and kind and I think that, you know, you kind of need that.
You need that yin
to draw out the real you, so you're not performing all the time, you know.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, because I think her personality really hooked us in, and I think what hooked me even further was, no spoiler alert, but the plot twist towards the end of the book,
So when did you come up with the idea, and how did that all come together with what you had written up to that point?
Well, I can't remember. I really wanted at the beginning. So the very first iteration of the book, there was no best friend and stealing of job. There was just her going up to Scotland and faking a CV and taking a job. And then I wanted to bring in her best friend in a way that created immediate tension. So I was like, oh, what if her friend had a job and said, oh, I don't really want to do it, and it didn't mean much to her, and she kind of brushed it off. And then I was trying to think about how to finish the book in a way that had a little bit of zing, because, you know, romance novels are, or this kind of rom-com novels are generally, you know, part of the joy of them is that you get to go on the journey and you know where it's going to end up, and it's really beautiful. But I just kind of wanted to bring something that was kind of to it. But funnily enough, not many people talk about it in reviews. I've been really surprised. It's not been something that people have said. And then there was this big twist, and I'm like, maybe it was obvious.
For me, I did not see it coming at all, and was completely like, what? So maybe I'm just clearly can't see the future as maybe some reviewers, but I did not see it coming.
Yeah, maybe it didn't. Somebody wrote in one review that it didn't matter in the end that it even happened, because everything else was so like, but I think it was important, because without giving too much away, it ties Heather, I'm giving it too much away, aren't I? But it does tie everyone in together at the end, doesn't it?
Yeah. And it kind of leaves you with a very, like, you feel very satisfied by the conclusion of it, I think, for everyone's sake. Finally, I just wanted to ask, you've got this release, are you already thinking about the next project, or is that something that is just too far away to even think about yet?
I've already sold my next book to Viking, and
oh my gosh,
and I'm in the US. So the next book is half written, and I'm just trying to find. It's amazing though. Like Katie said to me, you should get as much of it done before the book comes out, because you're going to be really busy. And I was like, And now every day I'm getting like, could you write an article for this? Could you do? And you're just like, oh my God, how am I supposed to write another book? I don't know how people do it. I look at people like Beth O'Leary, who bust out these beautifully crafted books every year. I don't know how she does it.
Magic people. Well, thank you, Lizzie. I know we've taken up a lot of your time on a Thursday morning, but if you just let everyone know where they can find you and kind of support the summer job when it comes out.
So you can, I'm on all of the usual social channels, although God, I find it exhausting some days. It's better to not be on Twitter, isn't it? Don't you think it's better to not be on Twitter?
Yeah, sometimes I just avoid the Twitter. I'm on it, but I don't really use it that much.
It's just like every time I log in, I see the trending topics and I get depressed for the rest of the day.
Don't look at that section.
Something horrifically bitter or toxic or upsetting, or Meghan Markle. It's like, that's it.
Yes,
like,
that sounds about right.
It's just, it's awful. But so I'm on Twitter. I don't have no idea what my handle is, but
basically search Lizzie Dent everywhere, and you can find
Dent Lizzie. Yes, you can find me on my website as well, lizziedent.com. And I'm on Instagram and all those other places as well. So the book's coming out on April 15th. It's in
nice
the UK.
For me.
Is it?
Yeah.
What star sign are you then?
I'm an Aries.
An Aries. All right, okay, because I've seen a bit of Aries chatter, a bit of Aries banter.
Yeah.
So you know, are you near the cusp then?
I think the cusp is something 20-something, right? Well, so I guess kind of near the cusp.
I'll say you're firmly in Aries.
Yeah,
then.
I'm a proudly firmly Aries.
I'm a reluctant Capricorn, because I'm supposed to be sort of organized and practical, and I'm none of those things. So I always joke that, like, I've asked my mum if I was premature or something, because I feel much more like a Sagittarius, but yeah. I'm not one. I'm a Capricorn. Anyway.
I'm definitely a Aquarius, but there you go.
Yeah, so 15th of April, it's going to be lots of places, including Sainsbury's, which I'm kind of excited about, because yeah. There's something great about it being in a supermarket. Yeah, so in all the usual bookstores, but, you know, obviously if you can, order from your local indie. So, yeah, it's very exciting.
It's really exciting. Well, thank you so much, and thank you for this book. It was just such fun to go through and absolutely loved it. So I'm excited for the world to read it and get their hands on it. But thank you so much for taking time to chat with us today.
Oh, no, it's a pleasure. Thank you for having me. My first podcast as a published author.
It's so exciting.
So before we get back to the episode, we just want to say a massive thank you to Lizzie for taking time to chat with us, and to the lovely team at Penguin for setting up this interview. Of course, make sure to get a copy of the Summer Job available everywhere this Thursday, and all your independent retailers or online.
Right. So should we move into obsessions for this week and what we're doing next week?
Yeah, trying to develop a hobby during Easter break. And then I'll probably spend most of this week, you probably just heard my cat's bell. I'll probably spend most of the week defluffing her and lint rolling all of my clothes that she thinks is a bed. And what about you? What are you obsessed with this week, and what are you going to...
I want to finish Pachinko this week, and then I will be... diving into Anika. I want to read that this week. I'm obsessed with my new body scrub. It's the best thing ever. It's like coconut and rose, and it's delightful. And I just went to Notting Hill and got some buns from home, which is the best thing ever if you're in London. They're delightful, 10 out of 10 recommend, and they deliver. Just kind of getting through this week, and obviously now we kind of are going to be a bit freer, which is very exciting. I will be dreaming and streaming Taylor Swift's Fearless, and then build up to April 9th.
Yes, yes. Praise. Cool. Praise.
Is there anything else we want to add?
I think that's everything.
Cool. Well, in that case, this has been another episode of The Rails, and thank you so much, everyone, for listening. Madeline, do you want to know where people can find you? Let people know where they can find you.
So people can find me on Instagram at @hey_itsmadeline. And I know that you're a lot better than me at social media. So where can everyone find you on your multitudes of social media?
Oh, right. So Imogenelle Marshall on Instagram or everywhere else, just head to offtherecorduk.com and you'll be able to get all the links in there. Have a great week, everyone. Bye.